All right. Well, we are going to get started. This is one I've been looking forward to for quite a while. Hello, everyone. My name is Jennifer Anju Grossman. Feel free to call me Jag. I am the CEO of the Atlas Society. I'm joined up here by my colleague, Scott Schiff, as well as our founder, David Kelly. And of course, our senior scholar, Richard Salzman, professor of political economy at Duke, to talk about inflation, essence, causes, and cure. So, Richard, I'll hand it over to you, but I'd love to just maybe get a set on where we are right now with the inflation rate, where it's been moving over the past few weeks and months, and then dive in.
Good. Thank you very, very much, Jennifer. Thanks for joining David, Scott, and others. This is really first of two parts. In 2 weeks, I'm going to do recessions. So we're experiencing both now, inflation and recession. So I thought I would devote these two clubhouses to it. An earlier clubhouse I did on price controls. So that'll come up today a little bit, but the focus will be on inflation. Now, in the headlines, if you will, Jennifer asked what's in the headlines. The general price level in the U.S., measured as the consumer price index, has gone up roughly 8 to 9% over the past year. That is the fastest rate in 40 years. So it's the fastest rate since Jimmy Carter. And what happened after Carter? Reagan and the supply-siders came in and fixed the situation, improved the value of the dollar. And we haven't really seen high inflation since then. So this is, in many ways, a return to 1970s style U.S. Policy, which I'll talk about in a moment. In the Q&A, I suppose we can devote more time to whether what's around the corner for inflation. Is it going to get worse or not? And why? And what are the policy responses likely to be? We're already seeing that. Thank you, Jennifer, for linking to this is an essay I wrote. I think it's a couple years old now. The production of money isn't necessarily the production of wealth. So that's at American Institute for Economic Research, and I write for them frequently. And there's probably two or three essays there on inflation, including how they affect stocks and bonds. So take a look at that website. Just search Salzman at AIER. Now, what I thought I would do for 20, 25 minutes or so, and then open it up for comments and questions is four things really. One, what is inflation? Two, how do you measure it? Three, what causes it? Four, what cures it? That's basically my mission. What is it? How to measure it? What causes it and how to cure it? And throughout that, I'll talk about one of the big topics will be the deleterious effects of inflation. Now, before I proceed and before I forget, let me give you some other really great sources in the literature, if you will, of free markets and objectivism. Not to boast, but my own book, Gold and Liberty, 1995, also available at AIER, I think for free. Just go to AIER. It's there in PDF. Gold and Liberty has a lot on inflation and the history of the gold standard. Ayn Rand in 1974 wrote a fabulous essay called Egalitarianism and Inflation, and that was reprinted in Philosophy, Who Needs It, if you want to look for that. Obviously, Francisco's money speech from Atlas Shrugged is a more philosophic take on money, the role of money, and inflation is a debasement of money, so you need to know what money is before you know what it means to debase it. Greenspan's essay in Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, is also good. Gold and Economic Freedom. Number one, inflation is a decline in the purchasing power of money. Now, I want to pause there because there's so much blather about inflation that you get a whole range of things and you can't keep track of what it is. You'll hear, because you'll hear OPEC or greedy labor unions or big meat. And they say big meat did it. So crazy, crazy. Just scores of alleged descriptions of causes of inflation. So to repeat, inflation is a decline in the purchasing power of money. Now, notice I didn't say anything about prices, and everyone thinks that, wait, prices are going up. Where's the price definition in there? Well, the purchasing power of money is what money will buy in terms of real stuff when you go shopping in the grocery store. You're exchanging pieces of money for goods. And if each piece is worth less, and we could talk about how that happens, but if it declines in value, you're going to have to offer more pieces per, say, I don't know, loaf of bread. So the rising prices is the effect, not the cause. So this is already philosophical. To mess up on inflation, and many economists do, part of it is they reverse causality. So you got to get the causality right. The identity of it is it's a decline in the purchasing power of money reflected in you got to use more pieces of each form of money to buy things. So the effect is rising prices. Now, the other thing to distinguish, rising prices for pretty much all things. This is not a what economists call a micro phenomenon, a microeconomic phenomenon, or industry specific, or product specific. That'd be something like, now suppose money is sound and there's no broad price level increase, and you just see a crop failure. You know, there's just a failure in, I don't know, wheat production or something. So you would get an increase in the supply, in the price of wheat. Supply and demand would tell you less supply, same demand, all else equal, the price of wheat is going to go up. That is not even Keynesian monetarist economists will not call that inflation. Inflation is supposed to be something broad-based, and that actually gives you a hint that it has to do with money, not with any specific product, because money exchanges against every product. Okay, and then of course all prices don't go up the same way or at the same time. So in inflation, a decrease in the purchasing power of money. By the way, the flip side of it is deflation. If someone said, "What is deflation?" It's an increase in the purchasing power of money. Now, let me just say something quickly, and let me move now to I'm going to get to what causes this, but let me just get to measurement because it concretizes it better. I've already talked about prices of things going up. So that's a kind of measure. But a broad way of thinking about this is the cost of living. Everyone knows that expression. The cost of living, what it costs to live. Buying food, buying clothes, renting an apartment, buying gasoline. So that's called the cost of living. And when you get inflation, the cost of living goes up. The prices of a bunch of stuff goes up. And all else equal, you do not want a rise in the cost of living. You want a decline in the cost of living. Different from living standards. You want a rise in living standards, but you do want a decline in the cost of living. By the way, not just for consumers, businesses as well want their costs to go down because they're trying to maximize profit. So all else equal, they make money if they can keep costs down. So this is a universal principle, and that's another reason to oppose inflation and to welcome actually deflation. Economists think deflation is the devil, but deflation is a decline in the cost of living. Things become cheaper every year. How wonderful. Not more expensive every year, cheaper every year. And that does tend to happen under capitalism. Though we haven't seen that in a long time because we don't have capitalism. All right. Point two, how to measure it. The most common measure of inflation is by looking at the effect, not the cause. And I haven't got to the cause yet, but let me just look to these measures to give you a flavor. CPI, when you hear the word, I'm keeping this somewhat basic for those who aren't familiar with the economic literature or the headlines. CPI means Consumer Price Index. What is it? It's a basket of goods. It changes over time, but it's supposed to roughly reflect the kinds of things the quote average consumer buys. And so the basket is weighted by the things I mentioned earlier, things like food, clothing, housing, gasoline, transportation, stuff like that. And what economists do is every month they run around, they send people around and look at the prices of these things and they record them. So if the consumer price index is going up, it's another way of saying generally prices are going up. And that's the number I measured, I cited at the outset, the 8 or 9% we're seeing now. It had been something like 1 or 2% a year for the most of the prior decades. And so 8 or 9% a year is a lot. It's a big increase in the cost of living. You can also measure it against other things, though, commodities. You can measure it against gold. When you see the gold price rising substantially, That is another sign that the dollar is worth less in terms of gold ounces. So the gold price under the gold standard, last time we were on the gold standard, 1971, it was $35. Now, what is it today? If you look in the newspaper today, the gold price is $1,800, roughly. How did it go from 35 to 1,800? I mean, other than just more dollars are spent on each ounce of gold, but if you look at the reciprocal, it's another way of saying, well, a dollar used to be worth 1/35 an ounce of gold. Now it's worth 1/1,800th an ounce of gold. It's the dollar that's lost value. It's the paper dollar and what it can buy that has enormously shrunk in the last 50 years, whereas gold has increased in value. Gold, the long-term historical money that welfare statists despise, has held its value and increased its value over this time. So even though major governments are not on the gold standard, it is not as if the gold value collapsed. So that's another way to measure this over time. And that is an enormous decline over time in the purchasing power of the dollar. The 8 or 9% we've seen over the past year is just 1 year. Okay, now, if inflation is a decline in the purchasing power of money, and the purchasing power of money is what a dollar buys, I'm going to use the dollar here, not foreign currencies, just for ease of conversation. What causes it? The answer is supply and demand. Of course, that's an answer any economist could give for any price. Why are the price of shoes go up or down? Supply and demand. Supply and demand. Well, but if this is still valuable because it applies to money, and this is very complicated, very abstract. People can't think of this as easily as shoes or wheat or gasoline. People generally do know what the supply and demand law is. All something like this: all else equal, more supply brings down price. All else equal, less demand for something brings down price. And then the reverse: all else equal, less supply, higher price. All else equal, more demand, higher price. I hope I said that correctly. Now, there is money supply and money demand. Most people are familiar with the money supply. The numbers are actually published, and you can find them on the Federal Reserve site. By the way, if anyone wants to be a number cruncher here, if you just put in Fred data, Fred as in Fred Flintstone, Fred stands for, I don't know, some kind of Federal Reserve thing, but it's at the St. Louis Fed. If you just put in Fred data, it'll bring you to a site. And then under search, just put M2. That's it. No space. M2. And you'll get a chart of the money supply. So in the US, the money supply is checking accounts plus currency, basically. There's also some savings accounts in there, but that is basically what the money supply is defined as. Now, what is money demand? Money demand is how much cash you hold in your bank account and in your wallet. Now, that's a more abstract than when people think of demand. It's not demand for money in the sense of, hey, I'd like a higher income. That's income. No, we're talking about cash balances, literally cash balances. And if you think of this now, try to work this through. If you do not trust the value of money, if you think it's losing value, you will try to get rid of it faster. You will try to spend it out of your wallet and your account and buy real stuff faster. That's called the velocity of money because you expect the price of stuff to go up. On the other hand, if it's the other way around, suppose you think prices will decline, then you would want to wait to buy stuff, right? And if you're really scared, here's another factor for demand. If you're really scared about things, if there's a financial crisis going on, or if you lost your job, or if it was hard suddenly to get loans from a bank, you would hoard your money. So hoarding, it's not a dirty word. Hoarding is just an extreme demand for money. And that increases the demand for money. Well, bottom line here is you can look at the purchasing power of money as an interplay between the supply and demand for money. But the biggest factor is the supply, meaning the reason the value of money goes down. The reason the purchasing power of money goes down, in other words, the reason behind inflation, is primarily an excessive increase in the supply of money. An excessive increase in the supply of money. Excessive meaning in excess of what people want to hold. If the shoe producers did this. If they looked out at the world and said, oh, look at that demand for shoes. But to hell with it, we're going to make three times as many shoes as last year. That would be crazy, right? Because the supply of shoes would plummet. They wouldn't make any money. So they have to calibrate to make money. They have to calibrate their supply to the demand. The government does not do that. And this is now an important issue. The supply and demand of money could be analyzed that way in any monetary system, including free banking and the gold standard, which is the capitalist system. Suppose there was no government involvement in money. Suppose the private sector alone provided money and banking services. You would still have this mechanism of supply and demand. It doesn't, it's ubiquitous and it's under every system. The question is, under a free market system, is the supply of money issued in excess? No, it is not. It's issued in accordance with demand, as every other product is. But that's not true when government takes over, co-opts the monetary system. So this is a good time now to say, because now we're in the field here of what causes inflation. The main cause of inflation, I would say, since at least the last 50 years, but you could go further back. But the reason I picked the last 50 years, actually 51 now, is in 1971, all the governments of the world, instigated by the United States, went off the gold standard. There has not been a link of any currency convertible into gold or related to gold, which again was the long-term historical monetary standard. None of them have been on it for 51 years. And that's, from my calculations, the longest stretch of time of, call it, fiat paper money unbacked by any tangible thing, for centuries. From 1714 to 1914, that's 200 years, Britain and America were largely on the gold standard. Not to get too much in history here, the last 100 years have been like an on or off thing with the gold standard. It was on and then off in 1933 under the Great Depression. Then they went back on it. Then they went off it in 1971. Now they're completely off it. Here, I'll get into that more if you wish in the Q&A. But here, I just want to say what the sequence of causality is. The main reason we have central banking is not so central banks can fight inflation or smooth the business cycle or make sure banks are safe or prevent financial crises. All the things you hear that economists claim central banks, that none of that is true. Central banks exist to fund the government. They're special, favored, monopoly issuers of fiat money in pay to the government, in total duty to the government, in cohorts with treasury and finance ministries. So they no longer, unlike in a free banking system, they do not issue money related to economic activity. They issue money related to government spending activity. And there's a bad feedback loop here. Once the government gets involved in money and its motive is to be able to print it virtually without limit, it also takes away any check on government doing that. So a government that wants to engage in deficit spending, which means spending more money than they take in tax revenues, that is an ingenious combination when you think about it, electorally, right? So a politician stands up and says, I'm going to spend more money. Yay, everyone votes for him. But I'm not going to raise taxes. I might even cut taxes. Yay, cut taxes. Of course, the difference is you're not going to be able to take in the revenues needed to pay for the spending. You get elected, but there's a gap there, right? There's going to be a gap between the amount of spending as the welfare state expands and taxes. Well, what's the difference? How can the difference be made up? The government either has to borrow the money and/or print the money. And that is what the central bank facilitates. That is predominantly whatever, not just the U.S. Every central bank is pretty much in the business of facilitating this process by which, call it profligate government, fund their excess spending without taxing the citizenry and getting thrown out of office. So the citizenry don't feel, if you will, they don't feel the full pinch of the higher government spending they're voting for. Why? Because the effects of inflation is to raise the price of stuff. Gas, food, clothing. And they look out and they say, the gas station did it. The clothier did it. My landlord did it. You see, so they're looking at the effects. They're not going to sit around and say, Jerome Powell did it. That's the Fed head. That's the head of the Fed. Some people go there, but it's a very abstract thing. It's hard to trace. For most people, it's hard to trace the sequencing. Now, even if, and this did happen, by the way, between 08 and very recently. Imagine now, even if the Federal Reserve or any central bank massively increases the money supply, which, by the way, it did from 2008 to in the 5 or 6 years after that, you would not necessarily see a higher inflation if what? If you get your supply and demand stuff down straight, if the demand for money also went up. You know, pari passu with the increase in the supply of money. And that did happen. But what does that mean? Think of what that means. Think of what it means that the government would massively increase the money supply and companies and households and individuals would hold it, would hoard it, would sit on it, would be very liquid, would not spend it. That would mean that the demand is keeping pace with the supply. But it's not a very good picture because hoarding money is a sign of fear. It's not a sign of confidence. It's not a sign of, hey, I think I'll take my money and start a new business. Hey, I think I'll take my money and invest in stocks and bonds or take a flyer on some new product. It's a fear-based kind of worrisome outlook for people. And but that just, I mention it only to solve the mystery for some people. Well, how can a money supply being going up, say, 20% in 1 year, but prices aren't? The answer is because the demand for money went up 20%. Well, what are we finding now? Now we're finding that inflation is going up rapidly. And if you look at the money supply, it has gone up significantly, especially since 2008. But the pattern since, I would say, really since Y2K. If you're old enough to remember Y2K, that was the turn of the century. And there was a fear that all the ATMs would crash and all the computers would stop. And all the lights would go out. And that was the first time the Federal Reserve massively increased the money supply out of fear, and there was no need for it. But then they also increased the money supply massively, guess when? After 9/11. And then they massively increased the money supply again, guess when? During the 2008 financial crisis. And they massively increased the money supply yet again, guess when? During the COVID lockdown. So we've had, is that four cases? In the last two decades, we've had four, by the way, wars have gone on as well. Wars are always sources of government just printing money without limit. There are four or five examples just in the last 20 years of cases where it was not necessary to do this, but a panicking central bank increased the money supply out of fear and never took the money supply back, never lowered the money supply after increasing it significantly. Okay, now I want to say something before I go to deleterious effects, and then I'll quit. There's an important distinction to be made between when you get to supply-demand issues, something called the monetary standard. This is very important to a sound, objective, capitalist-based money system. It's very relevant to the gold standard and how it works. So the idea of a standard. Notice in philosophy and objectivism, life is the standard of value, which means it uses, this is a gauge for deciding right behavior, right? So it's a guidepost. It's a kind of a fit. It's definitely fixed. Life is conditional, right? Life or death, black and white. So a standard is not some rubbery, flexible thing. It's a fixed thing. Now, in monetary issues and measurement issues, it's some kind of called the numeraire. That's a French word. Numeraire, or an example would be a yardstick. A yardstick equals 3 feet. Now that's an example of a standard. Now notice the yardstick is 3 feet every hour of every day. It's always 3 feet. Or what is a pound? 16 ounces. Or what's a mile? I think it's 5,028 feet. These things don't change every day. That's what a monetary standard is. And that's what the gold standard was. It was like a yardstick. The currencies of the world, not just the dollar, but the British pound, for example. Why do they call it the pound? Because it was a pound sterling. It was a weight of sterling, of silver. So in the U.S. Constitution, by the way, the weights and measures clause, which is really the government saying you cannot defraud people by selling them stuff other than how you describe it. That's where the monetary provision is. So the founders knew that proper money is standard money. And of course, they said, don't make anything other than gold and silver a tender in payment. So the gold standard is in the U.S. Constitution. The reason I mention this is notice that the value of a yardstick, say at a lumber yard, it does not fluctuate with the identity. It fluctuates with the supply and demand of the yardsticks, but its value is held because it's always 3 feet. And when the dollar was defined as a fixed weight of gold, it had that principle. And as a result, there was no, other than when government manipulated the standard, the history of the gold standard is neither inflation nor deflation. It's amazing. I mean, over long periods of time. I don't mean day to day. In other words, and economists have measured that. When you go back and look over these long periods of time, the longest study done, I think, was from 1650 to 1900. The purchasing power of currencies, when they are convertible into gold and silver, are very steady. And that's a really important property because you want money to hold its value, to be a reliable yardstick for the prices we pay for everything. That's completely lost when governments go off the gold standard. And as I've already said, they go off the gold standard because they need to print money beyond the money they raise in taxes. So keep that distinction in mind. Once you have a monetary standard, you can issue more of the thing without it losing its value because it's credible. Now, a quick history. The Roman Empire fell in large part because there was a big inflation at the end. Now, there were other reasons. There's a big philosophy behind this, obviously. But from an economist standpoint, there are many cases where when inflation takes hold and accelerates, it causes enormous political instability. And the most famous, of course, is the German hyperinflation in 1923. Now, hyperinflation, you get thousands of percent increases in prices every day or every hour. The greenbacks during the U.S. Civil War was a case of hyperinflation in the U.S. The Continentals, which were printed during the U.S. Revolutionary War. In France, the assignats, which were printed after the revolution, 1789. 1796. Latin America, almost all of them had big inflations in the 70s. And of course, the U.S. did after it went off the gold standard in 1971. From 1971 to 81, the gold price went from 35 to 850, and the dollar enormously lost its value. Now, some of the deleterious effects, then I'll end with a little bit on philosophy. Well, obviously, deleterious effects. Higher inflation, a higher cost of living. It's just harder to live. It's just harder to buy stuff. People on fixed income get absolutely ruined. What do I mean by fixed incomes? Older people who get annuities or pension plans, and they can't get higher income while prices are rising. So they're just crushed. Whereas people who are at work and getting price increases, you know, tied to inflation, are less affected by it. But it absolutely ruins people who are on fixed incomes. It ruins bond prices and hurts stock prices. When you see the stock market going down this year, that is in part caused by inflation. So your investment portfolio goes down. Now, tangibles usually go up. So usually commodities, gold, precious metals, art, your house, real estate, tangible things usually go up in value during inflation. The other couple of things deleterious about inflation, massive uncertainty. Not only when prices rise a lot, there's a greater variation in what the prices will be. They start fluctuating all over the place, which makes it harder to plan both personal finances and business. And interest rates go up. There's a technical reason for this, but all else equal, interest rates tend to go up. That's a cost of doing business, certainly borrowing, all sorts of things under inflation. There's a risk of price controls. That is absolutely deadly. If price controls, when you think about it, it is trying to cap the effect, not the cause. It's trying to stop by mandate prices from going up. But prices, we said, are the consequence of the value of money going down, not the cause. But price controls cause shortages, they cause dislocations, they cause disruptions. And if the government gets more invasive about it, it actually starts, you know, throwing people in jail for or fining them, you know, for daring to raise prices or wages amidst the edicts. So those are just some of the things. In Ayn Rand's excellent essay, Egalitarianism and Inflation, there's a very, very good discussion of how it, but you can get this in some economics too, but she's got the philosophy of it. It absolutely erodes the desire to save. It erodes the desire to invest. Inflation eats away and erodes at those things. But those are the sources of capital accumulation. Those are sources of productivity gains. Those are the sources of higher standards of living. So you cut out the pillars of all that, you get a stagnating economy, a slowing in growth, poverty, all sorts of things. So time horizons shrink enormously. When the prices of things are going up, there's less long range horizons. So there's a joke that under the hyperinflations in I think it was Bolivia, someone said, now, should I take a taxi across town or should I take the bus? And of course, the difference is the taxi you pay at the end of the trip and the bus at the beginning. So the value of money would fall so much in, 30 minutes that people would do those kind of calculations. And of course, there's a lot of standing in line and trying to buy things before the price goes up. If you know, in epistemology, there is a concept called nominalism, which is that concepts don't relate to anything in reality, they're just names. And the kind of money we have today and the kind of system we have today could be described as monetary nominalism. Governments just print money and don't claim that it's tied to anything, that it means anything, that it's convertible into anything. There is no objective money out there anymore. It's monetary nominalism. And so it's a move away from objectivity, really, and away from realism. The other philosophic angle I'd name, which I think I already suggested, is completely reversing causality. In fact, what gives money value? You can't eat this stuff. I mean, you can't even eat gold. What gives money its value is the creation of wealth. So wealth makes money valuable. Well, if you reverse the causality, you might think, hey, I can just print money and get wealth. And that's the Keynesian prescription. I mean, that is en route. Sometimes the monetarist, Friedman-type prescription as well, because Friedman was against the gold standard and for central banking. So both the monetarists and the Keynesians are responsible in part for the terrible monetary system we have today. But that be aware of that as well, this idea that people think since money, that the creation of money can somehow make an economy or a nation more prosperous. Not true. So for there, I would go back to the link of the essay that Jennifer put up that I wrote about. The production of money isn't the production of wealth. There's a chart in there that will shock you because you'll see that I think I anchored it in 1959. There are three lines plotted. And the one that goes up the most is prices. Broad-based prices. And the one that next goes up most is the money supply. And the line that goes up least is actual production. And I say in that essay, now what would you rather have? Production going up more than prices and money supply? Yeah, I think the answer would be yes. But the system we have today is the reverse. So I'll stop there and take comments and questions.
Great. I would also love to invite all of you in the room. Please share this room. Use that share button down below. Share it on Clubhouse. Share it on social media. It would be awesome to get some more people in the room for this discussion. Lawrence. Oh, and also before I go to Lawrence, I wanted to, David, you're up here and I always give you the first place. So I don't know if you had something that you wanted to reflect on what Richard had to say. And I also wanted to recognize that we have our other senior scholars, Professor Stephen Hicks and Professor Jason Hill in the room. So this is going to be great. David?
Thanks, Jack. I'm going to hold off for now. I've got a couple questions, but I imagine they'll come out and they're I'd much rather hear what some of the more people more knowledgeable about economics than I am raise. So I'll mute for now. Thanks.
All right. Thanks. Lawrence.
Thank you. Hi, Richard. My question is, I'm sure you've probably seen already, there was this announcement by Bank of America regarding no down payment mortgages for specific groups of individuals in places like Miami, Los Angeles, Dallas. And now while the Fed has always been printing money in a at the sort of national level, I was curious to hear what you would have to say about banks making sort of these more risky decisions where normal safeguards to judge whether someone can or should buy a house are thrown by the wayside for what seems to be equity measures. And I'm curious how you think this is going to shake things up and maybe cause, you know, supply and demand to get all messed up.
Well, thank you for that, Lawrence. It isn't directly related to inflation, but I would say that, and this is what you're describing, is similar to what happened prior to the 08 crisis with mortgages. It is true that under a system of central banking and unlimited money creation, that you get bad banking. You get, by bad banking, I mean reckless, not profit oriented, because the things you're describing are that, you know, no money down is a risky mortgage. And that was done in prior to 08. You know, on the idea that everyone should own a home, even if they can't afford it, a very altruist standard. The American dream was not everyone gets a house no matter what, but you worked hard, you saved money, and then you got a house. All the accoutrements of central banking, including the too big to fail doctrine, there's a doctrine that says if the banks are too big, they will be bailed out by the government. So that promotes reckless banking. The deposit insurance, government provides deposit insurance so people won't, for almost nothing, so that people won't run the banks. Running a bank is actually a thing that keeps banks honest, keeps them liquid, keeps them conservative. So we've had that since 1934. It's well established that government deposit insurance makes banks hold less capital and become more reckless. There's various other things I could name, other, you know, with government just like mandating that banks lend certain ways. But the phenomenon you're talking about, I actually wrote about in 19, long time ago, 1990, I wrote a book called Breaking the Banks, Central Banking Problems and Free Banking Solutions. And the point was that banking crises and banking weakness and banking recklessness is not due to the profit motive in banking. It's not due to any free market fault of banking, which is very common today. You know, anytime there's a financial crisis on Wall Street or elsewhere, they blame it on banks, on greed, on the profit motive, on deregulation, and effectively on capitalism. But actually, these are due to government involving itself more and more in the monetary system and therefore the banking systems.
Thank you.
Clark. Oh, nope, sorry, James. You were the here first.
Thank you. Dr. Salzman, in terms of trying to understand why does the increase of the money supply necessarily result in prices going up, is there any kind of very simple example that you can give us that would help us to understand why that there's a causal mechanism there?
Sure. Well, first of all, it's not, James, it's not, I hope to stress this, necessary that the money supply increase translates directly into price increases. And the reason is it's supply and demand. It's not just supply. So if the supply of money goes up 10%, say, as an example, but the demand for money, and I define that as holding cash balances, also goes up 10%. The two are offsetting each other in effect, and you would not get a decline in the purchasing power of money. You would not get a broad increase in the price index. But now in the case you ask, well, what about the case where the money supply goes up 10%, say, and there isn't any change in demand? What is the actual mechanism? When more money is created, each piece is worth less. That's really the essence of it. But to concretize this is true of any good. It would be true, as I said, of shoes or of loaves of bread. All else equal, if you produce more of these things, they're going to be worth less. And worth less when it comes to money means you have to put up more pieces of paper units of the money, so to speak, to get the good you want. Well, that is what prices are. Instead of paying $1 one month, you now pay $2. Why? Because each dollar's worth less. So that's the best way I can put it in terms of concrete.
All right. Hope that was helpful.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Doctor.
You're welcome. Okay.
Clark.
Yes, Richard. Thanks so much for this great presentation. But my question would be, if we take a walk down memory lane, let's say 40 years ago, how much of our current crisis, you know, the $30 trillion, I think it's 30, yeah, 30 trillion and counting, and our unfunded liabilities, how much of that doesn't go back 40 years ago to the essentially the deficits don't matter Republicans? And, you know, of course, I know Art Laffer, and I mean, I know he didn't intend this, where, I mean, his point, of course, is that, you know, when taxes are too high, and of course they were, they always are, but if you actually cut taxes, at some point, you're actually going to increase government revenue. And of course, that's a very solid, you know, proposition, but it got translated by, I guess, Republican politicians who maybe weren't very familiar with Mises and Hayek and, you know, the other three marketers. It got translated to like, hey, I'm for cutting taxes, so I don't have to show you how I'm going to balance the budget. And that's kind of, we're kind of still living in the shadow of you know, the Laffer curve and Kemp Roth. And here we are 40 years later. And it seems like, I mean, oh, too many Republicans just don't care about the red ink. And so what I know, you know, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, that's a good question. And it brings up other issues of what doesn't cause inflation. But let me just quickly say, because I'm a supply sider, but a balanced budget guy as well, that the insight and the truth of the supply siders, to their great credit, was they rejected both the Keynesians, who would print money without limit with if they were, and the monetarists and Friedman, who said increase the money supply, you know, 3-5% a year. The supply siders were the only ones in the last 50 years to advocate a gold-based money. Now, it wasn't a full gold standard because they knew they couldn't get a gold standard. But Reagan, for example, was for the gold standard. And and Laffer and others were trying to get Reagan to go back on the gold standard in 1981. He was talked out of it by Greenspan and Friedman. So Greenspan and Friedman opposed going back on the gold standard under the Gold Commission of 1982. But you're confirming a point I made earlier that when the Democrats step up and say we're going to spend more, but we're not going to tax, and the Republicans step up and say we're going to cut taxes, it's true that both parties, in effect, when you think about it, are contributing to wider budget deficits. They're contributing to deficit spending. Therefore, they're contributing to government borrowing going up. And the last sequence in that is they turn to the Federal Reserve and tell the Federal Reserve to buy the bonds. So that's if you don't know, that's what people call QE, quantitative easing. That's debt monetization. That's the central bank literally printing money and taking the bonds and giving the and crediting the treasury account with money. It is literally creating money out of thin air, which is why it causes inflation. But I do want to stress this point, Clark. If you hear someone say, well, we have inflation because the government's spending too much money, that's not technically true. That's relevant only if it leads to an increase in the money supply. And the same thing is true as deficit spending and debt issuance. If the government borrowed everything in order to meet the gap and didn't print money, there wouldn't be inflation. So it really comes down to what is causing the money supply to go up. And it's not that government spending doesn't sometimes lead to that or that borrowing doesn't. But spending and borrowing per se are not the cause of inflation. And notice we had a massive government spending and borrowing up until a year ago, and there was no inflation. And there was a decent increase in the money supply. You need a combination of the money supply goes up a lot and people don't want to hold it anymore. They don't trust it anymore. They don't demand it anymore. But as you can tell, I have mixed feelings about the supply siders because I think they did a lot of good, and they certainly brought down inflation in the 1980s and revived the American economy. But yes, they almost never say restrain government spending. They almost always say cut taxes. So it's a lopsided policy prescription.
Great. Thank you. John, so good to see you in the room, my dear.
Thank you. Richard, excellent presentation.
Thanks, John.
And it is focused on inflation, as that is the current in the news hot item. But I'd like to mention deflation and productivity increases.
Yeah.
And if we had productivity increases of sufficient size, magnitude, weight, then there would be no inflation, no matter how much money they printed. That is, if increases in productivity are balanced with the money supply, then you don't have inflation. The other aspect of that is no one in this room has ever experienced general deflation in the economy. The last time we saw that was in the evil era of the robber barons, 1870s through, I don't know, maybe 1910, when there was consistent every year, month over month, decreases in prices, where the consumer would walk into a hardware store needing something and think, you know, if I wait until the next train comes in, the price of nails will drop. And that if you have, if consumers across the board have that attitude, it makes for very competitive markets at every level. And that is partly why it's so difficult for people to understand the origins of inflation today. The only thing close to it was Silicon Valley in the 80s, you know, or 90s, when the price of computing was dropped, and that caused an increase in productivity. Generally, but it all, some of that was fake in the sense that now it was easier to hand a telephone call off to a telephone queue instead of having a smart secretary handle the call and route it correctly. So, and yes, computerization was deflationary, but in a narrow sense. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, thank you, John. I'm, as I said at the outset, I'm reluctant and I resist referring to specific products or sectors like computing or things like that to explain inflation or deflation, because it's a purely monetary phenomenon. But I do endorse your view that deflation should not be a boogeyman the way economists have treated it. By the way, the Federal Reserve has a target, claims, it has a target inflation rate of 2% or 3%. Of course, it's exceeded that. But I'm against even the target. Well, I'm against central banking generally. But even if I was for central banking, why would a central bank promise to increase the cost of living every year? It's ridiculous.
Under a
gold standard, and it was true under the gold standard, as you mentioned, the 1870 to World War I period, that was the classical gold standard. Yes, it is true that when there's free bank, there was no central bank then. We didn't have that until 1913. So free banking and the gold standard, I've shown from the period 1865 to about 50 years, delivered steady money and delivered steadily declining, sometimes fast declining prices, but didn't cause problems. Because when you think about it, if you're a businessman and the prices you're receiving go down, it doesn't mean you shut the doors, because your costs could be going down. In fact, your costs would be going down, because costs are just prices. They're just the prices you pay for the stuff you're selling. So the key in business is profit margin. The key in business, the motivator, is profits. And that's the difference between the prices you sell at and the prices you pay for the cost of goods sold. So if the entire price structure is coming down, you can still make money and you will still expand your production. That's exactly what happened in that period. The period you missed, John, and the one that economists still name for danger is the 1930s, of course, because the money supply collapsed 30%, the price level collapsed 30%, and one third of the banks failed, and that was due to going off the gold standard. So that wasn't a problem of the gold standard. That was the problem of FDR promising to go off the gold standard, which he ultimately did, And that triggered people running to the banks to get their dollars out so they could convert them to gold before they left. But that is not a phenomenon of capitalism. Unfortunately, to this day, if you ask an economist what caused the massive deflation of the 1930s, he'd say the gold standard. So they just blame the gold standard. It's a shame.
And I blame the Fed.
Quickly,
I blame the Fed.
Want to get to Jason.
Thanks, John.
Go ahead, John, but quickly, because I want to get to Jason before the hour.
I put more emphasis on increases in productivity during the robber baron era over the gold standard. And then during the Depression, I blame that on the Fed lending too much money to Europe to create the Roaring Twenties. I'll shut up.
Thanks.
Great points, John. Thank you. Jason, thanks for your patience. Good to see you. Jason, you want to unmute if you can?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Great lesson in economics, as usual. My question is just a basic sort of economics 101. My understanding is that we got off the gold standard. We got off the silver standard because China and Hong Kong got off the gold standard, the silver standard in 1935. So I just have two basic questions. Why did we have to go off the gold standard because China did? And what are your thoughts? I mean, the silver standard because China did in 1935. And what are your thoughts about the silver standard and its in term vis-a-vis inflation? You've talked at length about the gold standard and inflation, and I've learned a lot. But what are your thoughts about the silver standard in terms of inflation? And why did America have to go off the silver standard because China went off the silver standard in 1935?
Well, the first point, thanks, Jason. The first point I would make is you could use gold and silver interchangeably as a perfectly valid objective monetary standard. And both have been used in cases where they're both used together. It's called bimetallism. And so that's more of a technical point. But certainly silver-based money and or gold-based money is better than inconvertible fiat paper money. But the most of the U.S. history, the U.S. did start somewhat with silver, but then transferred to gold. There's very technical reasons for that. But the more important point is, why did the U.S. go off the gold standard in 1934? It was not, Jason, in my view, due to China. The key thing was Britain went off the gold standard. Britain was the most prominent economy and currency in 1930, but it was on the decline because of Keynesian policy. So the credibility of the Bank of England went down as Keynes became more famous. And Britain went off the gold standard on the grounds that it was preventing them from inflating, really, was their argument. And the U.S. followed after that. So the U.S. copied not China, but Britain in a very tragic way. Britain went off in September 31, 18 months later, FDR went off. But that 18-month period was very crucial because it was shocking to Wall Street and American investors that Britain went off the gold standard. Britain had been on the gold standard for 100 years. And so for it to go off the gold standard was a shocker. And it naturally led people to think, oh, my gosh, the U.S. is going to do that. And FDR at first said he wouldn't. Then he got elected, and there was like a 6-month period between taking office because the president took office in March at that time, not January. So lots of history here, but that's how I would put it. The arguments at the time for going off the gold standard were economies are collapsing, stock markets are collapsing, banks are collapsing, and the only counter to this is we need to be able to print money without limit, so let's get off this stupid gold standard. So they blame the gold standard and went off it for that reason. That's really the main reason.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Great.
Can I jump in for a second?
Please do. Yeah. And I'll put an invite in to Stephen, though not sure he's someplace where he can speak.
Okay. Richard, a quick question. For those of us like myself who mainly follow U.S. news, and have a lay understanding of economics. Watching the government vastly expand its budget and pump trillions of more dollars into the money supply, we've been kind of waiting for inflation to take hold. And so, but So your explanation of why it didn't happen is interesting. But could you? I wonder if you could relate this to this inflation appears to be a worldwide phenomenon. At least it's happening in Europe as well as the U.S. and elsewhere. Is the same? Are the same factors at work internationally?
Yes, the phenomenon is similar. You have welfare states all over the world doing this. Interestingly, believe it or not, less welfare status countries, and this is hard to believe, but I would include Russia and China in this, are not experiencing a decline in the value of their money because they're not full-fledged profligate welfare states. But the answer to your question, David, is yes, the underlying fundamentals are the same. The currencies, the major ones now, the pound, the euro, are, to the extent they lose value, it's also because people are losing confidence in the value of the money due to the fact that it's being printed almost without limit, due to the fact that each government is deficit spending. So they're hurting their economies, which makes the tax revenues depressed, but they're not depressing government spending. So the gap is widening. And investors know this, and currency holders know this, and it's a kind of a chickens coming home to roost story. But it was a head scratcher for a long time because, as I said before, between 08 and until recently, it's not as if there weren't big increases in the money supply. There were, and so people got very comfortable saying, "Well, I guess we can do this without limit, without any deleterious consequences." In fact, modern monetary theory, MMT, if you know, became very popular, less popular now. But MMT said just that. It's a kind of Keynesian prescription. The government could print money almost without limit and without bad effect. That's the theory. Bad effect meaning no inflation. But equally, it said, hey, it can also borrow money, a lot of money, issue a bunch of bonds, and all else equal, that would make interest rates go up, and interest rates aren't going up. So they had a two-pronged kind of magic wand. They can print money without limit, and they can borrow money without limit. And this was very sexy and exciting to the welfare statists, because that's how you win elections. You spend like crazy, but you don't tax people. You print money and print bonds. Well, notice what's happening. Both the value of money is going down. We are getting inflations now. And bond interest rates are going up. So the MMT people are kind of skulking away saying, well, I guess, okay, well, maybe we were wrong. Of course, they're not at levels, bond yields aren't at levels, David, that we saw in the Carter years. That was like 15, 16, 17%. The U.S. 10-year bond yield today is still only 3. So it seems like a very low interest rate given the inflation we have. So the inflation rate is above the interest rate. That means if you own that bond, you're losing money. You're getting a 3% interest rate, but the value of the money is falling 8% or 9% a year.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. By the way, this is a great, great talk. As a layman, I've heard George Reisman lecture and I've heard your explanation, and they're both models of clarity. So thanks.
Oh, thank you, David. Thank you, David.
Productivity. You have to have falling productivity to counteract inflation.
If there are no other questions, I did want to throw in something that might help people understand headlines. The Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, right, to, quote, fight inflation. If you understand the model I went through, the cure for inflation would not be to raise interest rates. The cure for inflation would be to stop printing money. And they won't stop. If you look at the money supply, I mean, it's come down a bit, the rate of increase. But over a 2-year period, they increased the money supply 40%. The economic output of the country didn't go up 40%. So raising interest rates, why are they doing this? I mean, interest rates go up anyway when inflation does, because lenders are losing money. The money that's paid back to them is worth less, right? So they charge more. That makes sense. So interest rates are going to go up anyway. But the reason I wanted to mention this as self-defeating is their real motive is to cause a recession. Now think of that. And they say this. They say it sheepishly because it sounds maniacal. And it is maniacal. Their view is inflation is caused, get this, not by too much money supply, but by the economy growing too fast. They think too much production of stuff You've heard this before. The economy is overheating. Another way they'll put it is the Phillips curve, if you know from textbooks. The Phillips curve says there's an inverse relationship between inflation and unemployment. So when unemployment rate is very, very low, it's hard to hire people. So you bid up their wages, and that, quote, causes inflation. And likewise, if there's a recession, if there's high unemployment, it's supposed to go the other way. You're not supposed to get an inflation. So what if you get high unemployment rates and inflation? That combination is not supposed to exist, according to the Keynesians. So they call it stagflation. But it's a very maniacal policy because the Fed, when you think about it, it's trying to slow the economy instead of trying to slow the printing of money. It's absolutely maniacal. But it's also 5 o'clock, so I'll stop.
That's great stuff. Appreciate that, Richard. Look forward to part two. Tomorrow, September 2nd, is Atlas Shrugged Day from the recurring date in her novel. The Atlas Society is having a big hour-long celebration on Zoom at 3 p.m. Eastern. Scholars, staff, donors, fans will be sharing stories. There will be a breakout room. We've also got our gala coming up October 6th in Malibu honoring Michael Saylor. We're going to have panels with the scholars during the day. We hope to see you at those events. I apparently have a lightning storm, but thanks everyone for joining us. And we hope to see you at these upcoming events. Jag?
Yep, wonderful. Thank you, Richard. Thanks, Scott, David, Jason, John. Always great to see you. And hope to see some of you guys tomorrow for our breakout sessions and discussion. Just go to the Atlas Society events section on our site, and it would be fun to see you there. So thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.